Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. Happy Monday. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio. And welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Peter Asher's legendary music career began in 1964 as one half of the singing duo Peter and Gordon, who amassed nine top 20 recording records during their career. Their debut single, A World Without Love, a song given to them by Paul McCartney, went to number one in over 30 countries, including the U.S. and U.K. In 1968, Mr. Asher became head of A&R for the Beatles' newly formed record company, Apple Records, where he found, signed, and produced James Taylor and worked closely with the Beatles on their individual projects. During this period, he became a key figure in the revolution of the 60s, founding the bookshop and art gallery Indica, where John and Yoko met, and where Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs visited, and found himself at the center of an era of profound social and artistic change. In 1971, Asher moved to the U.S. and founded Peter Asher Management, representing James Taylor, and beginning in 1973, the management and production of Linda Ronstadt as well. Peter Asher Management became one of the most successful artist management companies in the U.S., handling artists such as Joni Mitchell, Randy Newman, and Carole King, as well as James and Linda. Asher quit the personal management business in 1995 when he was appointed Senior Vice President of Sony Music, a post he held for 8 years. He has been awarded 37 certified gold albums and 22 platinum albums in the U.S. and many more internationally. Mr. Asher has produced 14 Grammy Award-winning recordings, and in 1977 and in 1989 was honored individually with the Grammy Award for Producer of the Year. He won a further Grammy in the category of Comedy Album of the Year for his production work with the late Robin Williams. After a 37-year gap, Peter and Gordon reunited in New York for one benefit concert for a friend on August 2, 2005, which was very successful, and they went on to perform together on various special occasions just for the fun of it until Gordon's untimely death in July of 2009. Since then, Peter has continued to be in high demand as a record producer, consultant, lecturer, and as a performer again in his highly successful one-man show, a musical memoir of the 60s and beyond. He has also received various international awards, is a member of Mensa and of SAG-AFTRA, president of the Los Angeles chapter of the Recording Academy, and has been a frequent keynote speaker at industry events. Other projects have included Carole King and James Taylor Live at the Troubadour, an album from guitar duo Rodrigo y Gabriela, Area 52, recorded in Cuba, and the Buddy Holly tribute, Listen to Me, an album and PBS TV special. With Hans Zimmer, Peter produced music for Pirates of the Caribbean 4, Sherlock Holmes 2, Madagascar 3, Man of Steel, and Rush. In fact, Peter sang and produced the only original song in Madagascar 3, the love theme, Love Always Comes as a Surprise, which Peter co-wrote with his friend Dave Stewart. Recent productions include So Familiar, the follow-up album to the highly successful and Grammy-winning Love Has Come for You, which includes Steve Martin and Edie Brickell. These albums have also generated a PBS special and a stage musical, Bright Star, of which Peter is the music supervisor. Peter also directed the highly acclaimed Hans Zimmer live show, which first opened in London in 2014. It is now on an extensive tour, which began at the legendary Coachella Festival in California. He recently worked with Steve Martin on a new bluegrass album with the Steep Canyon Rangers and with Elton John on the album to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Elton John Bernie Taupin songwriting partnership. In the New Year honors list for 2015, Peter Asher was awarded a CBE, Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth for services to the music industry. The official investiture took place at Buckingham Palace on February the 24th, conducted by Prince William, Duke of Cambridge. Most recently, it was announced with much fanfare that an official Apple-approved Beatles channel is to premiere on Sirius XM Radio at the end of May, and that the programming will include a weekly one-hour show from me to you, hosted exclusively by Peter Asher. Please welcome legendary guitarist, singer, songwriter, manager, producer, and half of 60s hitmakers, dynamic duo Peter Gordon. Peter and Gordon, Peter Asher to the show. Hello, Peter.
Hi. My goodness, sorry. It's a very long story, but thank you so much. Sorry, there was so much to sit through. I've been doing this a long time.
You've had a lot going on all these years.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've been busy, but, you know, I'm lucky to be still employed at my age, so I count my blessings.
I got to ask you, first question, so are you the real Austin Powers?
No. Apparently, the look of Austin Powers did derive from some photos of me. There are some photographs which you will see is a kind of startling resemblance. I had the bad teeth and the square black glasses and so on. No, I think the character of Austin Powers was derived from a number of people, but I am assured, in fact, that there were some photos of me back in the day that did indeed influence the look of Austin Powers.
Yeah, I think you had the closest look to Austin Powers. I kind of throw a little Peter Sellers in there, maybe, you know, but
yeah,
you were,
I think, I mean, yeah there are some photos when you can just, you know, and he, it's not a secret. He has confirmed to me that is the case. But I think the character was based on a number of people. Supposedly there was a DJ called Simon D, who I think may have been part of. You know, not that I wasn't essentially shagadelic, I'm sure, but I think there were other groovier characters than me, and upon the actual character itself was based.
Your new radio show, From Me to You, it already launched on May 25th, correct?
Yes.
And airs every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on SiriusXM. Now, that's on Channel 18, correct, on the Beatles channel?
Yes, the Beatles channel. I think it's 18, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting,
and it repeats a couple of times. It's so much fun. Something I've never done before, so I always say yes to that. And it's been great doing it. It's fun because I can play anything I like. You know, it's Beatles-related, but that gives you a very broad palette to choose from.
And you've had, let's see, May 27th through 28th, you had Abbey Road on the River, which you just finished up.
This memoir show I did
okay.
Abbey Road. Yeah.
And also, coming up, I'm just trying to plug as many dates and things that you got going on nowadays.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm doing the dates with Albert Lee. The legendary guitarist Albert Lee, who's, you know, played with Emmy Lou and played with the Everlys and played with everybody. He's the guy Eric Clapton describes as being his favorite guitar player. He and I do shows together from time to time, just acoustically, the two of us. And we're doing a bunch of those week after next, I think, on the East Coast. Well, I know we're at the Cutting Room in New York, I think, on the 18th, but I don't remember the other date to my head. But
I think you start the 17th. You start the 17th in Schenectady, New York.
Well, there you go.
Yep, and then you run the 19th in Philly. You'll be the 20th in Richmond, Vienna, Virginia, which is kind of my old stomping grounds. I'm originally from the D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other dates coming up all the way through, I think, July 22nd, where you'll be in Evanston, Illinois.
That's right. Yeah, I think there's some in June and some in July. We don't do actual, like, long tours because I'm usually in the middle of several other things, but I like it when I can jump in and do a few days. I think, like, this June, my dates, I think, are like a week, and then I come back home.
Well, you're a true Renaissance man, I can tell you that.
Well, I enjoy keeping
you're
it
amazing.
Very, because people often ask, well, which do you prefer, you know, and what I prefer is the fact that I get to do a lot of different things.
Well, another thing you got coming up, which is just announced, is next year on 2018, February 24th through March 3rd, you'll be the host of the Flower Power Cruise.
Yes.
Which is
I was on it as one of the guests last year, and it was really fun.
Right.
Mickey Dolenz was hosting last year, and I, you know, did a couple of shows on the cruise. It's great, you know, because first I was kind of going, is this going to be cool or is this weird, you know, but because of course you are a captive audience. I mean, not a captive audience, a captive performer. You know, because everyone, you know that everyone on the boat is keen on the '60s and so on. So, but once you realize that they're all there, number one, to have a good time, and number two, to remember an era that was particularly fun. Once you join in the spirit of that and meet all these people, it's actually great. I have a terrific fun and try to make a point of meeting, you know, there's a couple of thousand people on these things, so you end up meeting pretty much everybody and doing several shows so they can turn the audience over and everyone gets to see it, and it's fun.
Yeah, these music shows on cruises have gotten really popular.
Yep.
You know?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
I know there's a cruise for every era and every style of music, you know.
Right. Well, this one's going to star Peter Noone with Herman's Hermits, the Hollies, the Turtles, which I know. I've covered a lot of their shows, and I know Flo and Eddie.
Yeah,
they're awesome people. Felix Cavaliers and Rascals.
They've been friends forever, yeah.
They're awesome. He's now a professor, but Felix Cavaliers.
Oh, I didn't know. I'll address him accordingly. I didn't know.
Yeah.
Cool.
Felix Cavaliers, Rascals, the Guess Who, the Grassroots, Association, the Family Stone, and I think Can Heat and the Buckinghams, the Cow Seals, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. What a lineup, huh?
Yeah,
incredible
be great.
Lineup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now people can go www.flowerpowercruise.com, and I guess they can start getting tickets pretty soon or start booking.
Oh yeah, I think because they told me the other day it's like 85% sold out. So
already, really?
No, huh. Apparently it's doing very well. So because I was doing it was Abbey Road on the River when I was there. They had like a stall set up, you know,
right?
And they showed me all the bookings. I went, wow, you know, you guys must be making a fortune. It's it was just about sold out.
That's awesome. That should be a good time for everybody.
Yeah.
Studio-wise, I know you've worked with Steve Martin and Edie Prickell. I know Steve Martin, man. A lot of people in the industry have told me what a great, you know, banjo player the guy is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was it like working with Steve Martin?
It was great. I mean, I'm just finishing this new album now. In fact,
right.
I had dinner at Steve's house last night to play him some of the mixes. He's fantastic because he's an incredibly hard worker, a wonderful musician, takes it all very seriously, you know, despite the fact he's doing other things at the same time. And
right.
He's a great friend. He's very funny, but he's also extremely clever and well-read and just an all-around interesting guy. So, and as I said, exceptional musician, as is this band, the Steep Canyon Rangers, with whom he works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been fun. And working with him and Edie was amazing. They, you know, they started writing together just for this project, this musical. The album that led to the musical, and they just hit it off musically, big time. You know.
Yep, Steve and Edie are back,
stuff.
Right?
Sorry.
Steve and Edie are back, just like...
Exactly. That's the funny part. You say, I'm working with Steve and Edie, and people of a certain age find that hilarious, and then young people can't imagine why we're laughing.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Unfortunately, they don't know the old Steve and Edie, who were great.
Steve and Edie were awesome. They were a great duo. They were great singers.
Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet.
Yep, and Edie Gourmet, yeah. You also work with Hans Zimmer, and I was listening to you talk about Superman, that they did a session with 12 drummers. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was quite something. We set it up like on a sound stage, you know, like an orchestra. So we had all 12 drummers in a big circle, mic'd, you know, from above, mic'd individually and collectively. They were all playing the same thing. It was all that stuff when Superman's zooming around, you know, so that rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat drums, but they're coming all around your head. We did that by actually having 12 superlative drummers. We had the heavy-duty studio guys from out here in L.A., like J.R. Robinson and people like that. And then we had people like Jim Keltner, you know, legends of drumming.
Yeah, sure.
He played on all the John Lennon records and stuff. We had Jason Bonham.
Yep.
We had Pharrell Williams. We had an astounding... We were thinking, actually, while we were doing the session, we could have been selling tickets for, like, a drum clinic, you know, because some of the 12 best drummers in the world were all playing together. And they had the time of their lives, of course, because drummers don't usually get to play together. They're very much a solo thing, usually. You have a band around you, but you don't have another drummer. So there was a lot of drummer chat going on, you know, comparing bass drum heads or whatever they do, you know. But it was fascinating, and it sounded great. It sounded colossal, and you can hear it in the movie.
Yeah, I interview a lot of drummers. I recently did Billy Cobham.
Oh, wow, yeah. I've seen Billy. Yeah. He is, but he's amazing. Yeah.
And what was I going to say? The other, oh, was Carmine there by any chance? Carmine Appice?
No, he would have been a good addition. No, yeah. No Carmine, no Ringo for that matter. So
no,
there
Ringo
were some
either.
Omissions for sure, but we had a really hot lineup.
Now, do you like working on movie scores? It seems like you've been doing a lot of them.
I have, yeah. I mean, you know, Hans is the composer, obviously, but mm-hmm. I help him as in whatever way seems appropriate. Sometimes producing sessions like that one, you know, sometimes contributing song ideas, or sometimes writing a song even, and so on.
I had Tony Palmer on the show. Do you know Tony Palmer?
The director, the video director.
Yeah,
right?
The director, yeah. He's a nice guy, too.
He is, except he fired me once, but that's another story.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Sorry about that.
I was on a TV show. He had a television show. I think it was called How It Is, I think it was.
Right.
And the hosts were me and a woman called Caroline Kuhn.
Mm-hmm.
And we both got fired in a kind of weirdly not talking to you directly kind of way. So, yeah, everyone tells me Tony's a nice guy. I'll stay out of it.
I won't go there. My
recollections are less fond.
I talk to a lot of artists that get fired by Frank Zappa, too. So.
Yeah, we see Frank. I love Frank. Frank was a friend, but then he never had the chance to find me because I never worked for him. I was never a good enough musician to work for Frank, but I did work for Tony Palmer for like two episodes.
I think it was Jean-Luc Ponté was one of them that I think got fired eventually. But I can't remember, but they worked together for a long time. But
yes,
yeah,
yes.
He was a tough conductor. But he was.
Oh yeah,
he was
like
brilliant.
Miles Davis, you know.
Yeah.
The sheer fact you're working for him means you're a musician of an extraordinary caliber. Same with Miles. Same with Frank. No question.
Exactly. You're very proud of your work with Amanda Marshall. I like Amanda Marshall a lot.
It's funny you mentioned
it.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Well, because somebody asked me, I don't know where you found that, but somebody asked me what album I'd done that I thought had been, you know, underappreciated, and I mentioned that one specifically. It was an album called Everybody's Got a Story.
Yeah, yeah. I listened to that. It's awesome. She's a great artist. I really like her.
Boy,
a lot.
She's good. She's an incredibly great singer. I haven't seen her for ages. I was playing Toronto and called her up to see if she could come, but she couldn't, and I miss her. She's a very smart woman and an exceptional singer.
I know she toured with Jeff Healey for a while.
Oh yeah, cool.
Yeah, but she's from Canada, right?
Yeah, she's from Canada. She's great. She's also a redhead, of course, which puts her in an exclusive club.
are you still working with the Webb Sisters?
Not so much. I mean,
nope.
they. You know, they right now I think they're on tour with Tom Petty.
Right, right.
Singing back up with him. They're amazing singers. You know, we never did quite figure out exactly the record they should make to establish their own successful identity. You know, I love them dearly and would do anything I can to help at any time. But but I haven't been actively working with them for the last year or so.
Now, the first song you've ever bought was a Tommy Steele record, Rock with the Caveman, which
that's
I
right.
like. It's a really
it's
cool tune.
It's not bad. And you know who wrote that song?
I did know, but I forgot.
Lionel Bott, who went on to write the musical Oliver.
Right. That's right.
And Oliver. He wrote one of Cliff's best records, Living Doll.
Right, right.
Got myself a walking, talking. You know, he's huge.
Mm-hmm.
He was super giant in the UK, of course, and that was the number one record.
Sure.
And so Lionel Bott was great and went on to, as I say, write very successful musicals, starting with Oliver.
Of course, Tommy Steele's still around. I think he's like 80 now.
Yes, and I don't even know him. I don't think we've ever even met.
You've
but
never
yeah,
met
it was certainly
Tommy
the first single I ever bought.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
My first record that I ever bought was Sheb Woolley's The Purple People Eater. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. That's a good record. Yep.
Did you like Lonnie Donegan? Did you like Skipper?
I loved Lonnie Donegan. I was a huge Lonnie Donegan fan. I did get to meet him once.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, no, of course I had a skiffle group like everybody did. I was in a skiffle
group.
And Lonnie Donegan was fantastic. And it's still not much known here except for Brock Island Line and, unfortunately, does your chewing gum lose its bedpost on the flavor overnight? But some people, like Jack White, for example, is a huge Lonely Donegan fan. When I first met Jack White and got to talk to him at any length, we bonded over a fandom for Lonely Donegan.
You must have a pretty cool collection of LPs, huh?
No, none. I'm very bad at keeping stuff, and
really,
when I've moved and stuff, I'm not a storer and keeper at all.
You know, that's the same thing that happened to me. I mean, I had thousands of LPs, and I threw a lot of them away when I moved because I didn't want to carry them.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pain in the ass, and part of you regrets not keeping everything, but part of me definitely remembers what a pain it would have been if I had been dragging them around all my life. You know?
So they are heavy. Okay. They are heavy. Yeah.
Yeah.
You and Gordon first met at Westminster School, and what I realized, both your parents were doctors?
Yes.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
What kind of doctor was your dad?
He was primarily an endocrinologist, but he was interested in a lot of other kinds of medicine. He wrote books about psychology and stuff as well. He was interested in a lot of different stuff. He was quite a successful author. It wrote several books that are still referred to.
Well, you got a very intelligent family. I mean, not only you know your sister, your daughter,
yep.
also in the music business.
Yeah,
True. You and let's see, you were credited like A World Without Love, Nobody I Know, I don't Want to See You Again, and Woman. Mm-hmm. Those were all Lennon McCartney.
Yes.
That were credited.
Yes.
And that were given to Peter and Gordon.
Yes.
And you had a Del Shannon tune, I Go to Pieces.
Yep.
Was that given to you by Del Shannon?
Well, I'll tell you the story in all this. I Go to Pieces was actually, we were touring in Australia with Del and with The Searchers, a great English band. And Del had actually written this song that he didn't think was right for him, and he thought it would be good for The Searchers. So he was plugging it for them. He played it to them, and inexplicably, into my mind mistakenly, they turned it down. And we'd overheard it and said, oh, can we learn that song? And we did, and we worked up a harmony version and asked them to hold the song that we would record it when we got back to England. So, no, that wasn't written for us, and it wasn't even offered to us. We kind of picked it up, which is actually the same. You know, World Without Love was an unfinished song when I heard it. And it was an abandoned song because Paul, the Beatles weren't going to do it. John didn't like it and didn't think it was right for them. And Paul wasn't even finishing it. It didn't have a bridge and he wasn't writing one. So it wasn't until after we had a record deal in place, quite independently, just some, you know, EMI had signed us up after an A&R guy heard us playing in this club.
Right.
And actually intended us for us to be kind of folkies, not pop stars. But at that point, I went back to Paul and that night at home and asked if we could work up a version of that song, and he said, fine, you know, it's a giveaway, you know, it's abandoned. And then I had to go back to him to ask him to finish it and write the bridge, which he did in some infuriatingly short, you know, 5 minutes. And then the other songs they gave us, because that was kind of how it worked. You know, if you were, they took their songwriting careers seriously. And one of the obligations of a songwriter is if you have a big hit, you want to make damn sure you write the follow-up. You don't want somebody else selling records on your coattails. So we didn't have to go begging at all after that. After we came back from America, after our first World Without Love visit, Nobody I Know was already written and finished and everything. So then from time to time, Paul would write other songs for us, you know, and that's the category, I Don't Want to See You Again. And then Woman, as you probably know, he wrote, but asked if we would mind releasing it under a pseudonym, which was totally fine with us.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were suggesting that anything with the Beatles' name on it would automatically be successful regardless of quality, and Paul wanted to see if that was in fact true. So it came out under a pseudonym, Bernard Webb. And even though the secret came out a couple of weeks later, it was actually enough time for the song to prove that it was a hit, even without Paul's name on it. So it went straight in the charts and became very successful.
Yeah, I love all of you guys' hits, and you guys are so talented.
They varied a bit, because then we had things like Lady Godiva, you know, that was written by Mike Leander, which was kind of a really silly musical type of song.
I wanted to talk to you about that.
One of our biggest hits in America.
Hmm? Yeah, 1966 was my favorite year. It was a great time for music. My baseball team won that year, the Orioles. You know, I was originally from Baltimore, so it was everything was going right for me in 1966. And then Lady Godiva hit number six in the U.S., which was one of that, to me that was my favorite song by you guys. It really was.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it was kind of a risque lyrics too, wasn't it?
I mean, incredibly, as we had to get banned in some city somewhere because it was about a naked woman. It was slightly risque, I suppose, for the time. So a little mild by today's standards.
Yeah, but it was a woman. Not only the story about Lady Godiva, but she, you know, Hollywood was after her. Because she was naked, and she was going to come back.
She was a porn actress. She turned into a porn actress.
Exactly.
I know, it's funny. It is weird, yeah. It's a song about the glories of the porn industry, I suppose.
That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, didn't Lady Godiva also refer to a five-pound note? Is that a slang for a fiber?
No. Not that I know of.
That's what I read. I read that on the internet for some reason.
It makes sense that it would be rhyming slang. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't heard that one. Could be.
Huh. You kicked off the bass. Was that a bass intro before the banjo kicks in on Lady Godiva?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, originally it was a whole band, actually. Jeff Lovett arranged it with his whole band started, but I actually took everything out except the bass.
Right.
I was kind of copying a Kinks record. Which record is it that starts off the same way? Boom, boom, boom.
Oh, yeah.
Lazy on a Sunny Afternoon.
Sunny Afternoon, right.
I was stealing that. Completely, because I thought that the brass intro Jeff had written, even though it was cool, I thought it was a little too fancy, and I thought it'd be nice just to start with the bass playing the scale. And as soon as I did, I realized it was a total rip off of Sunday Afternoon. But what the hell? If you're going to rip anybody off, you might as well rip someone really good.
Everybody rips everybody else off in some way.
and you steal. The answer is steal from the best, and Ray Davis is the best.
That's right. I mean, rock and roll, we stole from the blues artists of the early, 20s and things like that. So, Which the Brits made famous again, because, the blues were not very popular in the U.S. anymore until the Brits came in
We basically taught you your own music,
Exactly.
We told you how good it was, and you'd missed it. I mean, I remember distinctly when, we loved American Rhythm and Blues and studied it very closely, and we all had the Little Richard record of Tutti Frutti, which was a big hit in England, and we used to look at the American charts because they printed them in Melody Maker, and when we looked and saw that you guys had made Pat Boone's version of Tutti Frutti number one, we couldn't believe our eyes.
That was a horrible time, the early 60s.
Well, exactly. Well, maybe we should have taken that as a prescient omen that as much as we admired America and loved its music, it is a country capable of occasionally making the most ghastly, misinformed decisions.
Well, I hate to say this, but...
By comparison with which, choosing Pat Boone over Little Richard is as of nothing.
I know,
compared to what you've been up to lately. Or we've been up to lately, I should say.
And you guys, all you had was the the BBC, right, for a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they couldn't play that many records. The Union had a bit of a stranglehold, and they didn't play many records at all. That's why we listened to Radio Luxembourg.
Right.
Broadcast from Luxembourg, and then of course after that it was why pirate radio was so successful.
Oh, the pirate radio, that was a good movie, by the way.
The pirate ship, exactly.
I think that was a great touch by you coming in with the banjo. Did you play the banjo a lot during a lot of songs or?
No, I did not play on that either. That was
you didn't play
guy.
The banjo on that tune.
I play banjo lately when we do it live.
Okay.
I don't play proper banjo, which to me means five-string banjo, like Steve plays or God knows, like Baylor Fleck plays. But I play banjolele, which is just like a ukulele-shaped, banjo-shaped ukulele.
I play some guitar. I can't play the ukulele for some reason. Not the ukulele and I can't play banjo either. It just doesn't come.
The five-string is very hard. It's all serious. There's two different styles, but it's hard. They're both hard. And... whereas banjolele is just like playing ukulele and is actually easy. You just have to learn slightly new chords because there's only four strings, but that's about it.
I saw you perform Lady Godiva on Milton Berle's show. That was interesting.
Right. Yeah. That's where they had me lip-syncing with a banjo, I think.
Yeah.
I think he was singing live, but I wasn't really playing banjo.
That was a lot of lip syncing back then. Even the Beatles did a lot of lip syncing.
You know, but when you did most shows like Dick Clark and all, you had to. That's why the ones that were live,
yeah,
Ed Sullivan, Shindig, and Hullabaloo, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the great live shows that were fun to do because you have to play with great American musicians.
Is it true that you objected to recording Lady Godiva, but
I originally wasn't in favor of it. That's correct. Yeah, I mean, Gordon was the one that sought me into it. I was kind of thinking it was maybe we shouldn't be doing like a novelty record, a
right.
comedy record, but he was right. It was a big hit.
Somewhere it said Gordon said it'll be funny, so shut up.
And that's it. That's about it. Yeah. Words to that effect. You know, I don't remember any actual real conversations 50 years ago, but that was the essence of it. Yeah.
And that tune was written by Mike Leander, Charlie Mills, and Gordon Mills.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah.
Gordon Mills was the guy who managed Gilbert O'Sullivan, who recorded that song once.
Yeah, he was good.
And managed Tom Jones. And I think the other Mills was his son, maybe. And Mike Leander is a brilliant musician who, of course, wrote, among other things, the string arrangements for She's Leaving Home.
Yeah, I've been trying to get Tom Jones to do an interview with him because I've seen him in concert a million times. For some reason, I just can't, you know, I know his wife just passed away, but I did get Engelbert. Engelbert's a good guy.
Tom's son manages him, doesn't he?
Tom's son does manage, yeah.
I haven't seen Tom for a bit, but he's a terrific guy.
Yeah, I talked to Engelbert last year and interviewed him. He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I didn't know him. We toured with him a little, but didn't really get to know him. Tom, I got to know pretty well back in the day.
Was there any rivalry between you guys and Chad and Jeremy, or not really?
Yes,
there was
because in a friendly way, they helped us get one of our early jobs in London. I think we replaced them in some coffee mm-hmm. house that they'd been playing, and then they moved on somewhere else and. Place they had been playing asked them to recommend someone, they recommended us. So it was a very amiable relationship. But yes, I mean, it was just odd because there were two duos so extremely similar that, you know, right. in each case, there was, you know, the short one wore glasses, sang the high part, the tall, handsome one sort of sang the low part. And that was true of both duos. So that we did get confused with each other. I mean, when they did, you know, Patty Duke show and Batman and all of those things they did,
yep.
you know, people would occasionally congratulate us. And then when we did Ed Sullivan, which they never did, people congratulated them and they gritted their teeth. So, but yeah, we did actually do one gig once all together in the later period. I mean, after Gordon and I got back together, so we did one gig all together and did a mm-hmm. version of Bye Bye Love with all four of us singing, just to prove that we were actually two separate duos.
Yeah.
And I saw Jeremy just the other day in London.
He's still touring.
He's acting. I mean, Chad and Jeremy still work occasionally, but right now Jeremy's in a play in London that's a big hit.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yep.
On May 29, 2010, there was a sold-out tribute performance for Gordon, which was held at the Cannery Casino and Hotel, which was, I guess, Waller's favorite Las Vegas venue.
Yeah.
And it was Peter Asher, Chad and Jeremy, Denny Lane, Terry Sylvester of the Hollies, Ian Whitcomb, John Walker of the Walker Brothers, and DJ Fontana, Elvis's drummer.
That's right.
So that was quite a tribute, huh?
Yeah, I didn't put it together, but they did whoever did a great job, and I was, of course, proud to be there and to speak a little mm-hmm. about Gordon.
Yeah, you guys were excellent together. You mesh well.
Thank you. We had fun singing together.
Yeah. This is a question no one can answer, okay? And you maybe you don't know, but I'm going to shoot it at you anyway. Do you have any idea why John, Paul, George, or Ringo never spoke with Pete Best all these years?
No, I don't know if anybody knows.
I talked to Pete. He's a nice guy. I've seen him perform, and he tells me he doesn't even know why they haven't spoke. I thought maybe there might be some kind of clause in the contract or something like that would prohibit. No.
No,
huh?
No, there wouldn't be.
Isn't that kind of odd, though? After all these years, you'd think he'd, you know.
I don't know. I mean, internal band relationships are like other people's marriages. It's like, you know, it doesn't pay to try and figure it out. You know,
I just thought it was strange. It was, you know, a lot of years have gone by. You know, and I think it'd be kind of cool if they brought Pete up. You know, maybe for one of Ringo's All Star events. You know, the All Star band or something like that. I thought it'd
be
kind of cool.
That'd be a bit weird.
But you think?
The guy who did him out of the job of a lifetime. Ringo's the guy he might see as having been prevented him from a life of you know, luxury and wealth and women and everything else. And, you know, I mean, Pete Best has to be pissed off, you know.
Yeah, but he's ready to bury the hatchet. I mean, he makes a few dollars on the side, you know, with the Beatles' name and everything, you know.
I know, that's weird, too. But
yeah.
I don't know Pete Best. So
you don't know, I guess nobody
knows. He seems like a totally amiable guy. But as I say, internal band relationships are complicated.
They are. I've been trying to get Mark Farner and Brewer together for a long time with Grand Funk because they're all still around, but that ain't going to happen. They won't get together either. You know what's cool is you heard "I Want to Hold Your Hand" before anyone. That was that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was fun. It was exciting.
Yeah, and it was Paul was living.
Paul was living in our house, you know. When he was going out with Jane, my sister, he was hanging around a lot. So our parents had ended up taking pity on him and offering him the guest room at the top of the house next to my bedroom. So he lived there for about 2 years, and there was a little music room in the basement. And that's where there was a piano he would use sometimes. And he was down there with John, actually, quite early after he'd moved in. No guitars, just the piano. And Paul called up the stairs to ask me to come down if I wanted to hear the song they had just finished. So I came and sat on this little sofa, and the two of them sat side by side on the piano bench and played that song for the first time.
You're a walking history book, you know that?
Kind of, yeah.
You really are.
Yeah. To the best of my recollection,
Now, McCartney wrote several songs inspired by your sister. What it says on the Internet is, "I saw her standing there, and I love her. You won't see me. I'm looking through you," and here, there, and everywhere. We're all inspired by your sister.
I have no knowledge of what was or wasn't.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's a lot of songs dedicated to her.
There's a lot of stuff on the Internet, so all I'm saying is I don't know.
Now, Jane has had a remarkable acting career, and you guys were both child actors, correct?
Yes. We both started around the same time, when I was 8 and she was 5 or something, we both did our first films back then, and then she stuck with it, quit school and kept on and took it seriously and became very successful and still is. I saw her in a play in London right now. She's in the London West End version of An American Paris, you know, the Broadway musical.
It's a huge
success. She's in that, so I went to see her in that.
And you guys played siblings back in 1955.
The only thing we ever did together, yeah, very clever. It's called Children of the Greenwood. It was an episode of the old Robin Hood series, the Richard Green black and white series, and we played peasant children. I'd previously played Prince Arthur in a number of episodes, but the Prince Arthur franchise ran out, and eventually I was demoted to a peasant child, and Jane and I appeared. But it was a good episode. Our father had been wrongly accused of something by the evil sheriff, and we were defending him.
Now, do you miss acting? Did you have the acting
still
bug?
I do miss it. I enjoy it, and every now and then I get to do it. But my last one was a couple of years ago now, at least. I was in a thing called Doris and Bernard, a very good film my friend Bob Balaban made about Doris Duke and the butler who controlled her life.
Right.
And in order for Ralph Fiennes to appear as the butler who was in the story, he had to be appointed the new butler, which involved the old butler getting fired in pages 1 and 2. And that was Susan Sarandon as Doris Duke firing me as the old butler.
Oh, yeah.
For serving her cantaloupe at the wrong temperature.
Yeah, you kind of have that little bit of a Shakespearean voice. You know, a little bit like, kind of like Earl Flynn. You know, as a matter of fact, Earl Flynn was just on the TV here, The Adventures of Robin Hood.
All right, that was a good one. I remember his version was very good.
His version was excellent. It's probably my favorite, I think. Yeah. Now, Jane, I give her a lot of credit, too, because she does a lot of charity work.
Yes, she does.
Autism
and the various foundations she works with in the U.K.
And she works. She's president of Arthritis Pain, I think.
That's right. Yeah. That's
right. So hats off to her because she's doing some wonderful, wonderful work. I want to talk just a little bit about James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt. I was just on a conference call recently with Linda Ronstadt, Emmylou Harris, and Dolly Parton. That was interesting.
Wow! How cool.
They were promoting the trio, the latest trio album, I guess.
Yes.
When was the last time you saw Linda?
talked to her on the phone quite recently, but I saw her within the last year. I don't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm. How's she doing?
She's okay. I mean, she's ill, yeah. You know, but it's not a great disease, but she's holding up well. She's in good spirits and as brilliant as ever.
Yeah. That's, you know, it's heartbreaking not to be able to hear her sing anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
It's such a great voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you work with James Taylor. I guess the story is that he moved to London. He was in the flying machine. I know he had a drug problem for a while.
Yeah, the flying machine was a New York band, and that band broke up, and he decided to go to London. He thought he had a girlfriend he could stay with in London. And it was our mutual friend, Danny Korchmar, who gave James my number. Danny played in a band called the King Bees that backed Peter and Gordon in the 60s, and we'd become friends and remain friends. So he said to James, well, if you're going to London, give my friend Peter Asher a call. So he did. So it, you know, came as out of the blue, and he came over to my flat and played me these songs that blew me away, and that's when I just got the job as head of A&R for Apple, so I signed him.
How did you realize that James Taylor was right? What was the, you know,
everything.
I know Apple.
I mean, everything. His guitar playing, his singing, his songs, his songwriting. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was nothing that wasn't super impressive to me. I just thought it was amazing. I thought I'd never heard anything this good in my life, you know. I was bowled over. That's why, you know, when Apple started to get weird, I wasn't about to give up on him. And that's when we agreed that I would become his manager and move to America and essentially bet my career on his. So my whole move to America, that whole bold throw of the dice was based on my belief in James.
Because were you also involved with the Ivies, who became Badfinger? Or,
well, I was when I was head of A&R for the label. I was involved with all the acts on the label.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
but then
Mary
once
Hopkin.
I quit.
Yeah,
Mary Hopkin.
Yeah,
yes.
Billy Preston. I think Doris Troy.
Yes.
Hot Chocolate. I think Jackie Lomax was another one.
I was less involved with Hot Chocolate for some reason. Maybe that happened a bit later. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Jackie Lomax, yes. I was in the studio for some of those sessions.
The title phrase of Taylor's Something in the Way She Moves, was that actually, was that Harrison that picked up on that and wrote the classic Something? See, I didn't know that. All these years,
James wrote the phrase first, but George kind of borrowed it, you know. But then, as James pointed out, Something in the Way She Moves also contains the lyric, I Feel Fine, which he borrowed from the Beatles, so it's all fair.
That's funny. And the other thing I didn't notice was McCartney and Harrison, were they guests on Carolina in My Mind?
I don't think so. I keep meaning to discuss this with James. McCartney was. He played bass on it. But there's all this stuff written about George Harrison sang backup on it, but he didn't. And I don't hear him on it. And I he's not listed in the credits. And people go, well, maybe that wasn't allowed. But why would I be able to list Paul McCartney on the credits and not George Harrison? So
right.
I don't. To the best of my recollection, and I have not conferred with James on this, I keep meaning to whenever it comes up, but I have no recollection of him singing on it. I remember him visiting us in the studio.
Right.
He was a James fan. He definitely came by the sessions at Trident Studios. But if you listen to that, it's me singing back up. It's James singing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hear any George. I don't remember any George. And as I say, most significantly, why wouldn't I have credited him? You know, there was no rule against him. It was their label, and if I could credit Paul, I could have credited him. Paul did play bass on that track.
Huh. Another guy you produced, I didn't realize that you produced, was Tony Joe White. You produced his third album.
Yeah, I did now with him. He's a great guy.
He is a great guy.
I haven't seen him for ages, but I love him. He's great.
I interviewed him, I think it was last year. And we talked about Elvis, and he's trying to teach Elvis a few chords, because Elvis only knew a few chords, and Elvis was stubborn. He didn't want to learn how to play more guitar than what he already did.
Right.
He actually looks like Elvis.
What? Sorry?
He actually reminds me of Elvis a lot.
Yeah, he's a great singer, and that, you know, pokes out of that, and he's such a classic.
Yep. I'm surprised you didn't produce any of Elvis's records, and you get involved with that.
I wish.
Yeah.
I would have produced Elvis. I was wanting to produce Cliff Richard too, and maybe I still could. He was our Elvis, you know. That would be, obviously any of those people would be a dream to produce.
Right. Well, you've done a magnificent job producing and managing for James and Linda through the glory years of both artists.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yep, I was lucky.
How did you and Linda first meet?
Somebody told me to go down. They said there's this woman singing at the Bitter End in New York. I was in New York.
Right.
Said, you have to go down and hear her. She's got this amazing band. She's an incredible voice. She sings barefoot in these really short shorts, and she's incredibly hot and amazing. And it was all true. Every bit of it was true. And of course, the band at that time, you know, was the band that became the Eagles. That was when Don Henley and Glenn Frey and Randy Meisner were all in her band.
Yeah, I saw her backing up the Eagles on one show. I think it was like 74 or something like that.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
I saw her later doing the her Mexican thing. In D.C., you know.
Yeah, I produced that show and those albums.
Oh, did you? You produced that show. That was a good show. That was an excellent show. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Linda and I did. I mean, and we had this guy, Tony Walton, who's a friend of Linda's, who's a brilliant British set designer who did the sets, which were astounding.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun.
And she made a living basically singing cover tunes as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but she had the voice, she had the looks, and
we were able to figure out some slightly different arrangements and new versions and stuff.
Yeah. Who didn't have the hots for Linda Ronstadt back in the day?
Hard to say.
Yep.
No, she's a brilliant and charming woman and gorgeous.
She is. I was lucky enough to interview someone else I had a crush on, which was Maria Muldaur, and I got to talk to her.
Yeah, she and Linda were good friends.
Yes, they were.
Probably are. I don't know, but
they were the hotties back in the day, I guess.
I haven't seen Maria for years, but.
How's your daughter doing?
She's fine. She's been in Iceland and Amsterdam lately, writing some songs with some brilliant writers over there, either for a project of her own or possibly for other people. So she's still very active. You know, the band she was in, Cobra Starship, a year or so ago. And she's been writing on her own, but she's doing fine.
She's a keyboard player, or was a keyboard player in Cobra Starship.
Yeah, the guitar player, exactly.
She also goes by the name of Vicky T, right?
Yep.
Very, very, very talented. She's on YouTube. Everybody can check her out on YouTube as well.
Yes, definitely. She has a new track out, actually, this week called Ghosts. That is fantastic.
What do you think about today's mainstream music?
Oh, I love it. I mean, what do you call mainstream? But there's some fantastic music out there. I'm a huge Ed Sheeran fan. He and I become good friends. I kind of wrote him a fan letter when he first started making it in the UK, you know, going... you know, I know a good singer-songwriter when I hear one, and you're it. You know, I think he's the James Taylor of now. And then we got to work together. We did a track for this previous Elton John tribute. We did a version of Candle in the Wind together, and he came and stayed out here in Malibu at my house for a few days, and we become good friends. Of course, the snag with Ed Sheeran is that when we're out together, people think I'm his dad. We look strangely similar, and we're both with red hair.
I'm still in the rock and roll genre. I still can't get my head away from that, but there isn't much rock and roll nowadays.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I love Fall Out Boy. I love 21 Pilots, but it's a slightly different kind of rock and roll. But I mean, that's my nominee for album of the year for sure. 21 Pilots record is just completely brilliant.
I like I always like Beth Hart. As far as you know, the blues and
absolutely
that
kind of, yes.
Yeah,
some I love Alessia Cara. She's my favorite new singer, or actually this new woman too, Dua Lipa, is just stunning.
Huh.
Amazing. I don't know if you've heard her yet, but she's totally happening. But
you did something with
lots of great singers out there.
I read it in the intro. Somebody was from Cuba.
Oh, Rodrigo and Gabriela. They're worth checking out. They're acoustic guitar duo. They're Mexican, but then lived in Ireland for a long time and play heavy metal tunes, among other things.
Really?
Yeah, check them out. Look at anything on YouTube. You'll be blown away.
Yeah, my mom was from Cuba, and I grew up listening to, you know, Celia Cruz in the house, in my household.
Right. Well, Linda, of course, is a giant Celia Cruz fan. But, yes, we went to cut the album in Cuba, which was exciting, a few years back.
Oh, so did you go to Cuba?
Yeah.
Oh, you did? What did you think of it?
We did the album there. It was great. You know, people were charming. Yeah. It was great. This was before the, you know, things got slightly less icy. So,
right.
You know, luckily, we went in from Mexico, and I used my British passport. For some reason, I decided I'd rather not be the ugly American at that point, but I chose which passport to use. But, great people, great fun, good
right.
studio, great, and of course, insanely good musicians.
Mm-hmm. Awesome musicians.
Yep.
Yeah, and the food's pretty good, too.
No, actually, the food in Cuba was pretty rotten.
Really?
I mean, the best restaurants were the ones that were kind of people's houses. They have these
right.
weird, or they did anyway, this kind of house restaurant thing, you know,
uh-huh.
where it's really a private house, but because you're not allowed to have your own restaurant. You weren't then. I think now things have loosened up. But they actually, like in the hotels, the food was awful.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We were in the famous old hotel, whatever it's called. But it was creepy food, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, my brother, who was born in Cuba, he's trying to, you know, arrange a trip now, and I'm still waiting.
Yeah, I mean,
for
I love Cuban food. I love going to Victor's
yeah.
in New York or something. And, but
oh, yeah.
In Cuba, it was not so good.
Huh. And I interviewed Lucy Arnaz, and she's
wow.
supposed to get a cruise together to celebrate Desi's 100th birthday and go to
uh-huh.
the town where Desi was, you know, born and raised. And she said, if you want to come on the cruise, she's got my name down, so I've been waiting for that.
Cool.
Yeah, I thought that'd be pretty good. Well, Peter, what makes a great producer?
A willingness to listen, I suppose. I mean, obviously, it helps to have a good ear and to,
mm-hmm.
to know what you like and stuff, and be willing to make decisions and keep things moving forward. And kind of, you know, I always think one of the key things of the producer is knowing when to stop. You know, and,
right.
and by that I mean knowing when, if a song's not working, when to abandon it. If a song is working, when it's right and not, you know, maybe you passed a good take 10 takes ago. You know, maybe you know when to stop overdubbing and. So the record doesn't get laden down to death. When the singer can has done enough vocals, you know, and it's not getting any better. You know, it's a question of, you know, there's a psychological aspect, advising and consulting the artist on what to do next. There's the practical aspect, not beating any aspect of the record to death, and knowing
right.
when to move on. Or if the song's not working, maybe at a certain point you go, well, maybe we don't like the song, you know. Let's try something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say. I mean, ultimately, part of it, of course, is the same answer I give when people talk about what makes a great manager, which is much easier to answer because it's an annoying answer, but what makes a great manager is a great act. You know, when
yeah.
I was asked to induct the first two managers into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which
right.
I was proud to do, there's no coincidence that it was Brian Epstein, the Beatles, and Andrew Lou Goldham, the Rolling Stones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got a reputation for being a good manager, it was James Taylor. So that, you know, that makes it very easy when you're going around saying, my act is amazing, and everyone goes, you know what, you're right. You know, that's what a manager wants, and that's great.
That's interesting. You know what I like about the 60s? I like that simple sound, I guess with the echo chamber. In the back, you know, I guess they use the echo chamber or whatever. You
yeah.
always hear that echo
yeah.
in the background.
Yeah.
I love that sound. I still love that sound today.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's some good records got made then, for sure. It was fun.
And they were simple. And sometimes
yes.
there's mistakes, but a lot of musicians say mistakes are good, but, you know.
Yes, exactly. Well, nowadays we can fix anything. Then we couldn't, so, yeah.
Here's a question I'd ask everybody that I interview. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform,
I never saw the
collaborate.
Movie, so you might have to fill me in on exactly
okay.
what.
Well, if you had a wish to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, and they could be deceased, who would that be?
Oh, I don't know. Well, you already suggested Elvis, so that'll do. I don't. You know, I don't really know. Because it's some of the people, you know, that I love that are great.
Right.
They don't need me. You know, they're making great records on their own already. So I wouldn't want to kind of mess with it. You know, when I do get to work with someone incredible, like when Diana Ross asked me to work with and stuff, it's thrilling and exciting. Somebody you've admired for decades
right.
or Neil Diamond or any of those people. And it's what's nice is that so far, whenever I've got to work with legends like that, they've always been as great as I expected. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So... I don't know. I don't really have a wish like that at the moment, I don't think.
Hmm. I got to talk to Julian Lennon, and he said it was his dad. You know, well, I know they've had issues in the past, but he did say it was his dad. So that was pretty cool. So what's next for Peter Asher? You got a lot of things going on. What's next for the future?
Well, I'm doing this Elton project, I think you mentioned.
Right.
You know, which is the anniversary of him and Bernie. So I'm working, either producing or executive producing the album with that. And we're getting a lot of big stars are going to be contributing to that. You know, redoing Elton songs. So that's going to be exciting. Hans's tour is still on the road, of course. I'm going to go and check on that in New York. And I'm just finishing today this Steve Martin album with the Steep Canyon Rangers. I delivered a ref to Steve last night. I have to make a couple of adjustments and actually have a conference call in exactly 6 minutes at 4 o'clock.
Oh, really? We timed it out perfectly then.
Exactly. I put it in right about after yours to talk about the release schedule and a possible listening session for that.
Awesome.
You know, I don't know. I can't think of any. And then I've got these dates, as you mentioned, with Albert Lee and so on. I don't know what my next studio project is going to be. I'm looking for something really cool waiting for something to turn up, but somehow it always does. Every time I think, uh-oh, I'm out of work, it never lasts. something cool seems to pop up.
I think you've been very lucky throughout your career. I really do.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah. We'll catch up with you again maybe next year and see what's going on.
Brilliant. Okay, please do stay in touch, and this was very good. Thank you, and thanks for doing your homework.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye. For more information about Peter Asher and upcoming tour dates, visit www.peterashermusic.com. Be sure to listen to Peter Asher's new radio show, From Me to You, every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sirius XM Channel 18, the new Beatles channel. Peter Asher will host the 2018 Flower Power Cruise on February 24th through March 3rd. For more information on that, I just found out that it's about 80% sold out, so hurry up and get your tickets for this cruise. It is awesome. Visit www.flowerpowercruise.com for more information. Also visit www.peterandgordon.net for further information about the legendary duo of Peter and Gordon. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsome with VBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at raypublicityworksagency.com. And please don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.